I wonder if you can have a god who can make a waffle so hot that even God himself could not eat said waffle. But that's a different podcast for a different time.
That must be New Testament right there.
Oh, that well, yeah, it's actually the book of Ego. Hey everybody, welcome back to our podcast, Everything That Rises, which is all about the short stories of the one and only Miss Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher, an author, a writer, a presenter, a word nerd, and I love Flannery O'Connor. I love English, and I'm really happy to talk about people who love the same stuff. And to join in the podcast with people who are smart and talented and maybe have a lot to share with their own experiences with these stories too. So each week we do a different short story. And this week I've introduced a guest who I've had a chance to connect with on his podcast. So I'm happy to have him here. You want to say hi to the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, John, first of all, for having me on this podcast. I love the idea of exploring Flannery O'Connor's short stories. So a little bit about myself. I'm currently a coordinator of instructional technology and integration services at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. So I get to help pre-service teachers think about using tech in their teaching. And before that, I was a K-12 tech integrator. And then before that, I was a high school English teacher and loved... Yes, much love. And I think maybe I know you said beforehand, no spoilers, but there is a teacher reference in here, which high school teacher.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Also, we forgot to mention your name. I forgot to say who you are. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm John Spike. Yeah. And English teacher. You never stop being an English teacher. That's the thing, too. I'm sure you can relate to, John. I know you've taken on other roles and things in addition to being a teacher, but that never leaves you. It's not like you call it quits once you move into a different role or title.
I'll be honest. I'm not really fun at parties because I'm trying to like analyze when like someone has decor. It's like, why did they make the curtains blue? What are they trying to express in their deeper meaning? It's like, I don't know. The curtains are just blue, man. But today we're diving into a short story by Flannery O'Connor. And as the rule for my guests, I always let the guests pick the episode today. So John, you picked one of the ones off the beaten path here for Flannery O'Connor. Do you want to tell us the name of the story and give like a Netflix style like episode preview about what we get into?
Yeah, we're doing A Stroke of Good Fortune by Flannery O'Connor. And yeah, I guess if I'm just doing a little snippet, this is truly like very simply put, it's a story of one woman's trip up the stairs of her apartment as she kind of reflects on a little bit of her life and has kind of, I think, a little bit of a reflective moment of, you know, growing older, the prospect of you know, I guess the act of what makes you an adult and what makes you who you are, and a little bit too of reflecting on her mother and reflecting on what she's kind of taken away from the people around her. I'm trying to do my best not to spoil, so I like caught myself. I don't know if you caught it, John, but yeah. I was like there, and then I just stopped. So I'm just going to leave it at that without anything. But it's a reflective trip up the stairs, which doesn't sound very interesting at first glance, but I really enjoyed this short story.
I will be honest. It is unlike most short stories I have read because typically they pick a character and they put a character in a position where they have a choice to make.
Right.
And they either make the right choice or the wrong choice, and then bad or good things happen. Here, this story, I mean, without giving too many spoilers, there is no choice that is being made in this story. There's something that kind of predates our story, and we are in media res, right? Like, but by the most dramatic, it's almost like the microscope is zoomed in too close, and then we kind of have to back it up. So here we go then. All right. If you wanted to find a copy of A Stroke of Good Fortune, it is available for free on the internet from some more legal than not channels. If you have other access, you do you, man. But I want to talk about Flannery O'Connor today. So if you haven't heard the short story, like I said, this one's where we're loving talking about it. It will take about 45 minutes to tackle the first half of the story as she climbs the staircase. And then we'll finish the second half with a big plot twist at the tail end. In the second half of the podcast, we'll do over the course of the next 2 weeks. So let's talk about A Stroke of Good Fortune. We have our main character. Her name is Ruby. And our first line is, Ruby came in the front door of the apartment building and lowered the paper sack with the four cans and the number 3 beans in it onto the hall table. John, initial reactions, initial impressions when you're just sort of in a world where Ruby exists.
Yeah, I don't know how you feel about this, and you might get into this with your other podcast, but I always feel like Flannery O'Connor's her final word is maybe stronger than her opening line. I almost think she opens with the ordinary and then drops you with the extraordinary.
That's,
you know,
and
yeah, and so this one, she definitely is opening us up on this scene that we are familiarized with. Like we can picture somebody struggling with groceries. So she sets us into, I think, a familiar scene with this. I guess the only thing that stood out to me was like the four cans of number three beans. And immediately Now I'm trying to figure out positioning myself like, as the English teacher, I'm positioning symbolism. Also as the like amateur researcher, I'm trying to figure out like number three beans too. And trying to put this together.
Yeah, I highlighted the passage as well. Like I highlighted the four cans of number three beans in it. And I took it to just be that this is oddly specific, which means that this person was either told to get those things and that's not a normal thing that they would buy, or it was a reminder of something that like is the day-to-day routine that this person is so intimately familiar with. Like, yep, every day I get the four cans of the number three beans or whatever it is. Like that, whatever it is, it could have been like, could have been with a sack of groceries, but it wasn't. And like, and this is what English teachers do. We parse over words, but here the first sentence is pedestrian, except it's not, because it's a fake story that never really happened. Right. So if she wrote it in, she wants us to see it.
Yeah. That's a great point. And I'm sure you and I each have those things that are just things that we are getting and that they, that those things are who we are. Right. Four cans of number three beans.
I get it. Mine is usually Pop-Tarts. I go with Pop-Tarts and like the cheese balls that they used to have like in the TV show The Office, where you like throw them and catch them in your mouth. Those cheese balls. Utz, I think, makes them.
Mine would be, my wife makes fun of me, assorted nuts and berries. I always go and get the same sack of assorted nuts and berries that always has the same mix. And I have a mild tantrum if I don't have it. And I feel like Ruby always has to have the, you know, or somebody in Ruby's household has to have that.
Has to have a very particular set of the certain thing. So here we go. So like she's making her way up the stairs and they describe her head balancing like a big florid vegetable. That's lovely. and then there's a dark spotted yellow mirror. She has, I guess, a leaf is poking out of this bag and she shouts muttering collards, because the collard greens are like up in her face and she smacks it away. And it's a repeated line, collard greens, blah, blah, blah. She's upset because her brother, who we understand is like coming back from war or coming back from the service, has requested that she make a special civilized dish. And he's like, oh, cool, I want beans and collard greens. And she's not happy about that.
Right, right. And in true, I know we haven't gotten to his name yet, but one of the best things about Flannery O'Connor is she is a master of naming characters.
Yeah.
And I think it's so fitting that he is Rufus. Like Rufus, I feel like carries a sense that like, because she has feelings towards Rufus, which we'll get to. And I feel like Rufus was a perfect name here for this guy who would choose collard greens and beans for the meal.
Well, let's push that. Like what makes you say, I agree with you that her naming stuff is never by accident. Right.
Right.
And I'm interested to hear why Rufus for you is one that you're like, she could have named him Billy or Bobby or Susie or Timmy, but like she goes with Rufus. Why does that fit for you?
I feel like Rufus, and I don't know if it's just like the cultural context I've seen it in, or I've seen dogs named Rufus. I don't know. I feel like it's a name that carries like not as much respect or regard as other names. I don't have any problem with the name Rufus. I love Rufuses in my life, but at the same time, like I feel like, you know, there's a connotation when you hear a Rufus, and I think it's just such a Flannery O'Connor name to give this character.
I think as a question of class, like we talked before we went on air, like a lot of times she'll play with issues of racism and classes, like, you know, and like expectations of, and I agree that Rufus feels like a junkyard dogs kind of name. Like it's just sort of a of the people kind of gritty.
Yes.
But I was also, and like, again, my spidey sense, because I've been reading a lot of O'Connor in the COVID shutdown, like, so there's, you pick up on patterns. She does unflinchingly make clues or hints about, they're going to talk about race, they're going to talk about class, they're going to talk about expectations of family. And so when I saw her, when her very Southern accent, I don't know how well-to-do she is, she's swiping away at these leaves by her face, shouting, colors, colors. I'm like, is this going to be a race story? Because swiping away that which is a colored would not be off-brand for the type of person of class and distinction in the South who is trying to, you know, like, brush back the old way of life and, or brush back the change. But in fact, she doesn't go that way with this at all. She does make a line about race later, but she seems more, I agree with you, concerned with class than race in this story, though it's clear that this character comes from like a Southern place with both of those things in play.
Yeah, I think you pick up on some interesting too. Sometimes I think she also likes to just drop in little in-jokes and tongue-in-cheek references. And I think that's what she is doing here. Like the collards give her an ability to slip in like a kind of joke. And she loved to do that. Yeah. You know, drop in like this little kind of dark humor or just on the edge humor. And she might be doing that even though, like you said, it's not really a focal point of the story. She is just kind of seeing, did you pick up on what I was doing there?
I love it. I also noticed that, too, she describes this woman, and again, because I'm predisposed, having read a lot of her stuff, like, it's going to go bad for this character. Let me meet first. It's not going to go well. Like, they describe her as a short woman shaped nearly like a funeral urn. I was like, oh, well, she going to die? Like, you know?
Yeah.
But plot twist, no, doesn't go that way this time. So we meet this lady, and she's on her way up the steps. She wants to make a nice meal for her brother, baby brother Rufus, who's come home from the service. And she mentions that she lives now in this he come back from the European theater, but they have moved to this place. Let's presume it's Georgia because it's always Georgia for her. But they grew up in a town called Pittman.
Yeah, again, I think there's some condescension in that name for sure. I mean, simply calling it Pitt, and then yeah, Pittman. I think she's also making a commentary about, you know, like what she thinks about that, you know, people from Pittman, you know, and she makes a comment too. We already know how she's feeling about her brother. He would have loved to have gone back to Pittman if this town hadn't dried up and dried out and shut down. And I feel like I grew up in a Pittman. I came back to it though, cause I enjoyed the people, but I feel like some people on the outside would call mine a Pittman, you know.
John, where are you from originally?
I'm from Edgerton, Wisconsin. Not a knock on my hometown, if any Edgertonians are listening out there, but you know, sometimes I think outsiders view us as, you know, maybe a little backwards, and maybe we have a minority of people who maybe have some backwards takes. But at the end of the day, like when you, I feel like, you know, zoom in as we're doing on this story, you know, you see the good in this community. But I this one hit home for me, the Pittman and the, you know, her kind of talking condescendingly about that. I feel like I've heard that many times.
She says, you know, all the people who had lived in Pittman had the good sense to leave it, either by dying or by moving to the city. Like, not great, man. She mentions that her ticket out of town was she marries a Florida man who sold miracle products. I don't think that's an accident. And his name is Bill B. Hill. I also noticed that every time she refers to her husband in this story, she calls him Bill Hill or Bill B. Hill. Like, he gets a full name treatment. And I'm reminded of The Office. Every time Phyllis talks about her husband, he's Bob Vance. He's Bob Vance. And when you meet him, he shakes his hand with you and he says, Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. Like, he's a full name that almost feels like he's selling you something by. And so when somebody did like a deep take, talk about a thematic analysis, they said, no, Bob Vance is a genius. He's getting free marketing because he knows they're doing a documentary on these people in the office building. So every time he shows up on camera, he's, oh, I'm Bob Vance of Vance Refrigeration, like with a wink and a nod to the camera, like, all right, that's where I go to get my fridge fixed. That's crazy. But here we meet the guy who's like her husband, who's a salesman, and his name is Bill B. Hill, and he sells miracle products. And that was enough to get her out of the pits.
And again, just a masterful, simple name, and it fits so much as we kind of evolve and see more Bill B. Hill, you know, comments and little nuances that we learn from Ruby. I think you find this name fits, and she definitely feels like he is a safe person who elevates her, and but he's got that simple Bill Hill name that is just, again, vintage Flannery O'Connor, just giving you a little smile. And yeah, you're spot on. Like, the fact that she calls him Bill Hill just says a little bit about, you know, what she considers and how she kind of utilizes her marriage to him strategically.
Yeah. And I think that's really cool, because if the person who gets you out of your pit town, his last name is Hill, right? There you go, right?
Yep.
It's not mountaintops. He's not a church. He's not like some sort of heavenly thing. He's just a little bit higher, and he's like a lame, rhymy name, Bill Hill. But that's enough to be, as she says, the kind of husband, you know, that she would want. It was mortifying to let, as she says, she feels that when her brother talks, he's an embarrassment. He's like, oh, it was good for absolutely nothing. I seen it after 5 minutes of him, she told Bill Hill. Bill Hill, with no expression, says, well, it only took me three. She's embarrassed to let her low-class brother, who, spoiler, will never actually show up in this story, be seen by her high-class husband, who also is not here.
Yeah, that's one of the crazy things, too, about this story, John. I don't think it's too spoilery. We'll meet characters on her traversal up the stairs, but some of the most important characters never show up in this story, which is also just an interesting piece about it.
I would argue, good sir, this is maybe too literary of it, but you know, it's what you do over like a glass of brandy and just, you know, pontificate. I would argue that the single most important character is not ever going to arrive in this story, but will arrive at another time. And maybe that's a stylistic choice by the author to talk about the people who she takes for granted in her life and the type of things that are on their way as she's awaiting a stroke of good fortune.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that.
I don't know that that's true, but you know, like I said, it's my podcast and I'll edit it to sound like I'm smart. So it sounds great. So she gets to the bottom of these steps. And she says it's stuck up like a steeple step. The minute she stood at the bottom of them, they reared up and got steeper for her benefit, as if the world's out to get her. And I think that's like, you know, oh, woe is me. I'm so luckless. I'm at the foot of this thing. And she talks about she's going to climb to the fourth floor as she's on her way up. She thinks back to this trial that she's currently undergoing, and she envisions like a prophecy, I guess.
Yeah, I also just want to put, like, I underlined, I just love that, like, she described the stairs as rearing up at her, like the stairs mm-hmm. literally are just trying to intimidate her out of wanting to make this traversal. And I just love this journey of the stairs, like centering the story. It reminds me of a lot of other good stories that people would argue, well, nothing happened, but you're like, a lot happens on this trip. And The fact that this stairwell is kind of like trying to almost coax her out of going up is interesting choice by Flannery here.
It's like a metaphor. I mean, like, it's like a metaphor. No, that's a simile.
you just, like, I have to revoke your ELA license. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Yeah. I've been out of the classroom for like a month, man. So I'm just like in quarantine, do the best I can. Not. So she's on her way up the stairs. She says she's in no condition to go up. And she was sick. And she talks about the prophecy that she had heard from a woman named Madame Zolita. And Madame Zolita, we come to learn, is the palm reader, the palmist on Highway 87. And she had said a long illness, but then added, whispering with a very, I don't know already, but I won't tell, look, it will bring you a stroke of good fortune. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about, like, so for my faith tradition, and you don't have to be of the same faith tradition as the author ever, but I happen to be Roman Catholic, as Flannery O'Connor herself was. So immediately when you hear about things like palm readers and prophecies and tarot cards and futures and fortune tellers, that's gonna raise a red flag with our author. So we're gonna presume, if that author is, you know, very very faithful, practicing, devout Catholic, that would come from a realm of here.
Right.
I'm interested to hear your first take on this Madame Zolita, like the prophecy character, or like the world of this very secular predictions that she kind of dabbles in.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if you zoom out the lens and you're thinking about the Flannery O'Connor collection, you know she loves to do stories about people who maybe like go through realizations. And so with her showing that Ruby values Madame Zolita's palmist reading, you kind of framed it as this person, you know, is drawn to the occult. They're drawn to these things that are outside of maybe, like you said, that Roman Catholic sphere. So I think a little bit if it triggers my like Flannery O'Connor O-meter that this character is something going to happen, you know, involving, you know, this occult take and how is the Catholicism that runs rampant through her kind of moral ethics stories. How's it going to impact this prediction, I guess?
Well, we have to talk about it. I mean, like, and that will come up in the second half of this story, major spoiler, but like faith, value, belief systems of the Catholics, right? And it's particularly a Vatican I Catholicism that would be that world that Flannery O'Connor is living in. You meet Madame Zolita. She's an occultist. She's somebody who comes from like a place outside of the tradition. And she's giving a prediction about not like grace, which would be the word that we would use in the Catholic tradition, but rather fortune. Like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, God has blessed me with these things would be how we would say it in a Christian tradition. No, you are fortunate. Like fortune's wheel is spinning up or spinning down. And it's a very, I mean, like, for lack of a better say, it's a pagan way to present when things that are happening, they're not gifts from God, they're spins of the wheel, they're luck of the dice. And I think that that does draw you into this idea of, especially if the author is doing a little bit of judgment in this, like she says, you know, she would bite her tongue if her it wasn't so firmly always planted in her cheek. Like, here we have something that she's okay, fine, yep, and we just take it at the face value. I'm reminded also of like the music of Bruce Springsteen, who talks about like the boardwalk, and he cites Flannery O'Connor as a major influence, and he talks about like Madame Marie, the palm reader, and like the fortune tellers. It's like, it's just a different oeuvre, I guess. And that it feels a little like, I don't want to say lowbrow, but just like seedy and sketchy. when if this woman is climbing a thing that's supposed to rise like a steeple, this is the English teacher, like she's about to be in a pilgrimage towards a revelation, towards grace, towards, you know, some divine thing. Meanwhile, there's hints of like, I don't know, this very earthiness, this very seediness at the beginning of the Basic Steps. But anyways, here we go. So she said she hadn't made plans for 5 years, but now she was done. She's tired. She's like, I just don't like climbing. I'm feeling fat. I'm feeling older. What do you think you're going to do? You know, like, make this happen? So she wants to go to Meadowcrest Heights, you know, move away from this walk up and make her way up. You know, she's getting old. She's 34 years old. You wouldn't think that five steps was slower, but here we go, man. She says verbatim, and I love this, and now we are tipping our hands. Warning, there be spoilers. You better take it easy, comma, baby, comma, she told herself. You're too young to bust your gears. I missed that like the first 2-3 times.
Yeah. First of all, what's really powerful, you mentioned the 34 thing, and I know we haven't gotten to the line yet, but you know, she's going up there, and yeah, you noted she has this very clear, you know, separation of baby in there. But it's a couple of things that stand out to me. First of all, that one thing that happens a lot in the story is she seems fixated on ages. I've never noticed her bringing up how old everybody is in any of her other stories, but this one, like, she beats you over the head with ages, and she, almost every character, I can tell you their ages, you know, after a couple of read throughs. So that obsession over ages is really interesting in this. But yeah, the take it easy, baby. She told herself, you're too young to bust your gears. One thing that I think will come through about Ruby is she gets very obsessed with, I feel like, where her age falls in the continuum too. And she seems to kind of teeter totter on where it is. And one thing that drew me to the story, and the reason I said to you I'd love to do this one, is I am really identifying with Ruby. She makes this line, the very next line that we're looking at, 34 wasn't old. It wasn't any age at all. And I feel like that's where I'm at. Like, I'm 32 and I do feel like it's not any age at all. Like, it is, I don't think I'm young anymore. I don't think I'm old. I haven't hit like a crescendo age of 40 where somebody might lump me into a, you know, has been or anything like that. Not
easy
to knock
there,
any.
Fat.
Yeah.
Let's go slow. Yeah. Some of us are getting a little close to home.
I just lost a bunch of the audience, but you know, like, people might start, you know, assigning labels. I feel like I'm in no man's land. And I feel like that's what she's saying, is like, 34 is nothing. Like, there's no, there's no great association with 34. And I feel like that at 32, like I'm not any age at all. And I think she is very much trying to figure out where she is in her life during part of the story. Yeah. And that's where that age obsession comes from.
I like that as an idea here too. She also talks about her own mother, or like the character's mother, and thinking about at 34, where am I versus where my mom was? Mm-hmm. She compares herself. And that's another thing that in O'Connor comes up a lot, is that continuum of, well, where am I in comparison or relation to everyone else? And that's not a good thing to do. Don't say I'm holier than them. Be holier than yourself. Don't say I'm better than them. Be better than yourself. But she talks about her mom, she, you know, and there's a little bit of maybe self-doubt or delusion there. She says her mother's hair had been gray. Hers wouldn't be gray now, even if she hadn't touched it up. Like, okay, lady. But she thinks about her mom and her mom's, look, again, to be trauma informed here for a second, everyone kind of speaks from their own place of trauma. She says in her own childhood, you know, she remembers her mom made older by the fact that mom had so many kids, and every one of them made her a little bit older. She said, made deader by every one of them. She says, but of those children, it was 8 of them in all. 2 of them were born dead. One died in the first year, and one was crushed under a mowing machine. Her mother got in debtor with every one of them. And all for what? Because she hadn't known any better. Pure ignorance. There is a trend here. We have to talk about it. Like, this is that moment, you guys, we need to talk about. talking about family planning in a Catholic lens here, that she and Bill Hill will later talk about how they are careful, how they are aware of their family planning, they're mindful of it, and that her mom, she paints as ignorant, had no such awareness, no such science, no such protection, puts her mom in a place where now mom is popping out babies left and right. And that seems to be like a point that Ruby points to her mom and is like, see, that's why she was stuck in Pittman. Like, cause she was like barefoot and pregnant all the time. Almost like a, this scene is a flashback judgment on the way that her mom didn't even think to live, just lived because, well, that's who she is.
Yeah. I totally agree. It's interesting. Her relation reflecting back on her mom and her choices. And this is obviously the scene where we really get the tone sets, where she kind of lets out at 34, she sees where her mom was and she sees the toll that the children have taken. And that is part of that where she's sitting here like, I'm kind of in no man's land in terms of where I am with my age, but at least I didn't let these children, you know, sap some of the life out of me that I've got. And it's interesting. Yeah. She definitely, again, talks with that condescension like we had with Rufus and Pittman. You mentioned it here. Like there's that condescension that Ruby is going to conjure up with different people. And again, you also mentioned too, that comparing where you are in terms of, like you said, am I more devout? Am I good country people? Am I doing the right thing with my life? You know, whatever the Flannery-ism that you're working with. She always is going to be doing the stacking, and she starts off the, you know, in the beginning with her family and comparing them. And it doesn't stop here.
No, she does. She's just, you know, she had two sisters, were both married 4 years with four children apiece. Like, that's a good shot to take at Catholics, because they do get married and they have babies real quick. And that's a very traditional Catholic way of thinking at, like, large immigrant families, Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants. Even today, like the geographic center of the church is in Central and South America. Like, this is the tradition of large, loud families, seems to be the story that this woman is recalling of her own, this fictional character, Ruby. She's the only one of the children who couldn't stand it, the noise of a brother being born. So she says, quote, she walked 10 miles to the picture show, and she would prefer to sit through Westerns, two Westerns, and a horror movie, and a serial, and it was somehow still less noisy than her parents' house. I don't know, you mentioned your own kids. Like, are there days where you're like, I want to just put on Call of Duty and blast stuff because it's quieter than watching the kids bouncing around the walls?
Yeah, I feel like... I feel like too, she has framed it entirely on like defining them by their offspring too, right? She hasn't talked about anything else about her own mother, like how good of a mother she was. It was all about how she let, you know, this happen, you know, eight kids happen, and her daughters that aren't her, you know, had four apiece. And that's the only framing we get about those two characters off the bat is they dried out because of all this burthen and everything, like you
correct
said.
All that burthen and they had married from around,
like, oh yes.
All the people who are here are local, and again it is we talk about like in Flannery O'Connor, in the Flannery-verse, there's a trope or a convention of the person who thinks that they are smarter than the town in which they are born, and they can't wait to get out, and they resent the people around them for it. Like, they're so local, so provincial. Like, if you watch that first scene of Beauty and the Beast back, Belle is kind of a jerk when she sings her song about, like, how this provincial town is so awful. Like, the baker just gave you eggs, the guy just gave you bread, the guy just gave you a book, and she's like, there must be more than this awful place where, like, these people don't read books. Like, check your privilege there, sweetheart. I don't know.
Seems like everybody's great.
Yeah, right. Amen. So anyways, so here she is, and she's thinking about her brother and growing up there. And she was extremely young and looking for her age. You know, not that 34 is any age at all. Again, repeating. And then talking about how she has four flights to climb, and there are 28 steps in each flight. 28. So on the way up, I don't know. Let's you run a quick interruption here real quick for our listeners. John, you also host a podcast, and it's about laughing through education. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Yeah.
and we can quickly plug your podcast here. Now's a natural segue for that. if folks want to find it on the internet, where is it available on their streaming services?
Oh yeah, absolutely. If you go to laughedpodcast.com, you can check it out, and it's on pretty much any major streaming, you know, platform: Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, all that good stuff. But yeah, I bring on people like John who crushed his episode. They tell stories of being an educator and and being a student. And I think you had one about like maybe a crude tattooing or something like that.
You know, who remembers?
Yeah, you're like, I don't want to get into that.
This is a family podcast here. But very quickly, the reason why I bring it up, I always think that the guests who we bring in are the exact right person to talk about this story, because we got to talk about humor in Flannery O'Connor here. So yes, the Laugh Ed podcast, absolutely worth checking out. John is a fantastic podcast host who brings on people to tell funny, sometimes slightly awkward and occasionally on the borderline of tiptoe to off color stories as the educators. Sure. Have you ever had to hit the explicit tag or have it had any episodes flagged as explicit by your podcast?
I've checked some of mine as explicit, just ones where, you know, I know they went into the guests went into adult themes. Of course, I would never do that.
No, of course not.
But yeah, I've had to flag a few myself.
And you've been very gracious about that. So we're gonna make it very clear here that we're gonna try to keep this family PG, let's say PG-13, but let's talk about sex jokes. Because in this podcast, I don't know, man, like we are spoiler talking about family planning. We're talking about being careful, being protected. And as she's walking up and down the stairs, she's, oh, can't walk. Oh, blah, blah, blah. She sits down on the stairs and like collapses and oops, she sits on, wait for it. Young boys, 9 inches of treacherous tin. It was a pistol belonging to a Hartley Gilfeet. Am I doing that English teacher thing where I'm making something into something that it's not?
No, because you know Flannery O'Connor too, you know she has a character named Manly Pointer in a story, and you know that this is totally what something she'd do.
Yeah, and it's very on brand because later she tells the upstairs neighbor when she's carrying this gun in her hand, "Where'd you get that?" "Oh, I sat on it." Like that's a very offhanded kind of joke to make, which again is taking our brains as adults and as adult readers to the idea of, again, family and relations between man and woman, husbands and wives, moms and dads. And she's thinking about that too, because she trips over, awkward, this tin phallus on her way up the steps. She mentions she would probably clobber the kid because he's not a great, she doesn't like him.
Yep.
But she remembers that in the boy's past, or the boy's dad passed, and the boy's mom now calls him Little Mr. Good Fortune, because as all daddy ever left me, his daddy had said on his deathbed, "There's nothing but him I ever could give you." And she said, "Oh, but Rodman," again, Rodman. "You've given me a fortune." And so she calls him Little Mr. Good Fortune. I don't know. That feels like it's the less said about it, the better, but it feels pretty there.
Yeah, I would agree. A little heavy-handed by Flannery, maybe with the innuendo and also the callback to the good fortune, for sure.
Facts. And the fact that the very next line, and again, this is what tipped my spidey sense off. So again, if you're a younger reader listening to this, like, this is what English teachers do. We just look for patterns, and maybe we're wrong. Like, there's maybe red herrings in here. Like, I was looking for earlier, I mentioned collard greens, because I know that race is something as a theme in her Southern literature. At this point, I'm like 3-4 pages in. I'm not seeing a lot of racial stuff. Okay, so I'll put that on the back burner. But she mentioned, "You've come a long way, baby. You got to relax yourself." Now she's thinking about her own mom, her own family, and then Rodman and a big chunk of tin. Then the next line, she says, "The steps were up. She did not want to get nauseated. Not that again. Not now. No, she was hot." I'm like, oh, come on, right? Like, we're there. If it walks and quacks like a duck at a certain point, like, you know, but she says she didn't want to go to the doctor. She repeats again the phrase, "No, no, no, I'm not going to a doctor. No, no, no." She was, just hot. They would carry their knocked out. She'd done doctoring herself all these years. Are you like me? I feel like I my vehicle, like I drive an old car. I had a Ford Focus for forever. And like when it starts to make noises, you're like, oh, that means I have to go to the dealership or like the repair shop. And so you just like turn up the radio a little bit. Like you don't have to hear it. And you're like, no, it just needs to like just rest a little bit. Or it needs like a good car wash or a new tank of gas. Is that a human thing that maybe I am guilty of? Or is that more of the human condition that we try to doctor ourselves?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I wrote in my margins. So I went old school back to my glory days and marked up the margins of my book here. And I wrote denial.
Respect.
I wrote denial on the sidebar of this. Like, she is in denial of what's really going on. Now, again, spoilers, you know, I feel like we've nipped around them, but I
think it's spoiled at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I really saw her going through these different stages of, like, you know, trying to come to grips with what's happening in her body. And this was her just totally, you know, in this denial stage, with all of these. And you're right. I do the same for my car. I'm in denial that it needs something, and I'm going to pretend like, well, I didn't truly hear it, so I don't have to address it, you know?
Yeah. And the idea is, if I go to the doctor, they're going to tell me, and that's true.
Yeah. Right?
Like, that's a very chicken and an egg. Well, that talk about fertility issues. Like, just because you talk about it or don't talk about it doesn't mean that it happened or didn't happen. Here it says she would have had 5 children right now if she hadn't been careful. Like, and we're talking about O'Connor and talking about Catholic teaching. And you mentioned Good Country People. Like, in the story of Good Country People, the Bible salesman, Manly Pointer, steals a girl away from her family. He pretends to be a Bible salesman, and they sneak up to the woods, sneak up to the hayloft. And then she believes she's seducing him, when in fact he's trying to set her up to be screwed. And it's a big old sex joke. Like, he's going to screw her, all right, but not in the way that you think. He opens his Bible, and his Bible is hollow. And inside of his hollow Bible, he has playing cards, he has whiskey, and he's carrying condoms. Like, that is very not what O'Connor would want to see a person of faith carry as their religion. Like, contraception is a big hang up in the Catholic Church. And here, when she's saying stuff like, they had been careful, Bill had taken care of it, and we're talking about, like, going to a doctor and moms and dads stuff and nauseated, like, it's there now. We're spoiled. Like, this is a pregnancy story.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, I was kind of interesting from the Catholicism lens. You know, I think one of the things that I don't know from a perspective of, there's a lot of things that go unsaid, or it's kind of a don't ask kind of situation. And this story, she spends a lot of time not outright saying it, almost like she's afraid to address it too. It's interesting that a lot of, again, what's left unsaid is very telling.
And again, like, this is a difficult situation. And, like, to empathize with this character, whether she goes to that doctor or not goes to that doctor, she has to process this thing. And right now, there's a lot to process. That physical strain of climbing up steps is but a mirror of the thing that is much deeper, which is like an emotional, mental, you know, romantic strain inside of her. Like, all that stuff's happening at once. Talking about, you know, as she's thinking about her own baby brother, right? Real quick, guess what? There's more to it. But so they say that she's nothing permanently wrong with her. You know, she was fat and her color was good. And she just got to get up the steps until she says she's warm and fat and beautiful, but not too fat, because Bill Hill liked her that way. She knows she put on a little bit of weight. Okay, fine. And then again, she finds herself at the first neighbor's landing. I guess there's 4 flights to go up, so we're going to meet, like, a character on each of the next couple of landings. We meet this guy, Mr. Jerger. Thoughts about this guy, the second floor resident who was so peculiar?
I feel like another reason I connected with this story, John, is I don't know if you share my fear, but I think this is where I'm headed, where I'm going to be the quirky former high school English teacher who, like, randomly pops off factoids, you know? So I feel like it was looking into the future a little bit, which terrified me just from a personal level. That was what I took away. But this was another, this scene that we're going to be kind of getting into is an interesting, like, kind of heavy-handed move by Flannery O'Connor, you know, where we're headed with this character. But it is interesting, like you said, we almost have, like, these characters she meets on each landing, and the order that she presents them to Ruby is interesting too. I'm curious to see where we go with this in the conversation.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like, we have flashbacks to the characters, like, family who existed before, and then along the way we meet the gun of a little boy. We don't meet him just yet. We meet Mr. Jerger, and then we'll meet, like, the upstairs neighbor. We'll get about the halfway point of the story. We'll take a breath there, and we'll learn a lot about them as we kind of go through it. But Mr. Jerger here, like, he shows up, and that's creepy, that be like, oh, I'm that retired old teacher popping off factoids. John, I'm going to be direct with you. I don't ever plan on retiring. I plan on working until I die. Like, the COVID shutdown is as close as I'll ever know to retirement, because I'm of a generation where I just don't see that as a prospect. And if the economy is where I think it's headed, I'm going to be working really hard for a really long time.
Yeah.
When I'm 78 years old, as this character is described, his face looked as if it had mildew on it. Ouch, man. Like, ooh. She described him as if he looks like a goat, little raisin eyes and a string beard. His jacket was green, almost black, or his black was almost green. I don't know, like, he feels like Mr. Hooper in Sesame Street. Like, he's a pure character, and that's so rare to encounter here in O'Connor, because normally everybody has an angle or a motive. It seems like he's just genuinely a friendly neighbor who just has the unfortunate reality of being old and looking like a goat.
Yeah, and maybe his, you know, what he gets excited about doesn't resonate with everybody else, but he presents it in usually a, for the most part, a kind way. You know, he does have the unfortunate line, like, I think he says something to the effect of, young people don't really think anymore, which is a retired teacherism that is timeless. I don't think this is unique to, you know, the 1950s or whenever she's setting this story, but you know, late 40s, 50s. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, this is a character who really is presented not so much that we're supposed to feel one way or the other, or watching massive change.
Well, I think this is really cool. And like, we talk about it as we kind of push this character a little further, because he's like, in some ways, he's a stock character, like the wise old professor who lives upstairs. But in other ways, like, he has a little bit of personality and just enough, like, aw shucks gumption or wisdom to him that, like, maybe he's the soothsayer on the steps, giving you a heads up that he's easy to dismiss, but his prophecy is true. And the reason why I think this, for like two or three reasons, he asks her a trivia question. He's like, do you know whose birthday it is today? And she's like, Abe Lincoln. She's like, come on, you're not even trying. Like, George Washington. He's like, no, it's Florida. Your husband is from Florida. And I know that about him. So he's trying to make an honest thing, like, that would be a particular quirk or ism that was tailor-made just for her. And I think about that almost in like a foil to like this Madame Zolita character, who gives like a fortune telling, which is like a generic thing you can say to anybody. Oh, it's going to be bad, but then it'll be good.
Yes.
Like, why would you go to a fortune teller if it was already going good, man? It makes sense, right? Like, it's Miss Cleo. Call me now for your free reading. Like, you're taking advantage of people and their desire to be told that it's going to be okay eventually. But this guy has actually done a little bit of due diligence. We get into his room and we realize, like, he's kind of a quirk, maybe a little bit of an old coot, but he's put enough thought into, oh, you're that lady who lives on the fourth floor. Your husband's from Florida, right? Hey. And he mentions something about Florida. He tries to show her about Florida history. And they say that, quote, a single transparent bulb hung down on Mr. Jerger and a small table. There's a little bit of like, there's an illumination, like a light bulb literally over his head when he says, you know, something happened on Easter Sunday, which is a very important religious thing about illumination. And then, like, you know, seven lines later, looking for the fountain of youth, you know what? You find it inside of yourself and no one even thinks anymore. Like, that's not accidental. There's like, I don't know. I think he's like, Madame Zolita is like evil but good twin.
Yeah, he's got these cryptic messages, but his might come from like a more personal place that understands Ruby a little bit better than the next person, right?
What do you think of that line that he says, where nobody thinks anymore, though? You mentioned that earlier, and I'm interested to kind of push that too.
Yeah, at first glance, it struck me as a, you know, this always like the generation, it doesn't have hope for the generation coming behind it. But it is interesting, because one thing that tends to happen in this story is people are really kind of taken aback a little bit about like Ruby and really her not, you know, not addressing the elephant in the room, or the you know, the child in the womb, I guess, to make a poor rhyme here.
That was rhyming. I like that.
Yeah. I didn't think I would rhyme room with womb, but here we are, John. Yeah, it's really a great opportunity.
I think that's West Side Story. Womb to tomb, sperm to worm. Good for you, brother. But I think that's it, right? So like, he says he has drank from the fountain of youth in his heart. And he puts his hand over and she's like, yeah, deuces. See you later, friend. And as she walks away, angry at him, she says, oh, God almighty. And darker as she goes up the stairs that gets steeper and steeper. Well, let's call it out. Either God exists or God does not exist. It's a binary state. You can't have a God that half exists. I wonder if you can have a God who can make a waffle so hot that even God himself could not eat said waffle. But that's a different podcast.
That must be New Testament right there.
Oh, that well, yeah, it's actually the book of Ego. But she's like, you know, God almighty. She's using the words God. And for O'Connor, faith is a binary state. It's the Misfits line from A Good Man Is Hard to Find. You know, Jesus was the only one who ever raised the dead, and he shouldn't have done it because he threw everything off balance. If he did what he said he did, and he was who he said he was, then there's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. Like, that's it, man. If God is real, everything that was said about God is true. If it's reported with veracity from the people who are supposed to have heard it, if he did what he did and he said what he said, then guess what, man? You can't like half take stuff. So that she uses the word God Almighty almost in vain here. Like, I'm done with this guy. I'm blowing this off. Like, she's leaving a story about Easter and about Revelation behind her. Now she's about to go up the stairs. Well, she also is dabbling in psychics and fortune tellers. She thinks immediately right back to Madame Zolita. And like, the road ahead is dark. I, as a Catholic, and again, I'm raised on it, so I apologize if it sounds like I'm proselytizing. I'm not saying you have to be Catholic at all, nor do you even have to have – I'm just asking like that you understand where she's coming from, right, as the author.
Right.
What she's saying is, if God exists, there is one path, there is one step rise to follow, and even if you're walking with infirmity in herself, like O'Connor herself, you know, dealt with lupus and she was in crutches for most of her life, it will end in not good fortune but grace and salvation. Meanwhile, Madame Zolita comes from a totally different sphere. And if you're leaning into that stuff, like, you can't go half-assed to the Jesus walk. You're either in or you're out.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see this character, you know, you have to wonder, what was she going to Madame Zolita? Because maybe she didn't find the answers she wanted in her kind of Catholic upbringing, right? You know, was she kind of reaching out? This might have been, like you said, you know, we've got Mr. Jurger, another kind of prophet of sorts, and he's, you know, offering something different that she doesn't buy into either. And so there's all these different, you know, avenues being kind of that she's pursued or being presented to her. And it's interesting, as she's, as you mentioned, you know, escalating up these steeple steps, you know, what goes on.
Well, I mean, this is where we have to, you know, kind of break it maybe. And what we'll do is like a cliffhanger for next week. I mean, O'Connor will say often that her stories are typically about moments where you are presented the opportunity for grace that are typically refused. Like, people are given a chance or a choice and say, nah, I'm not going to do it. I'll do it this way. And that sort of brings about their next steps or their downfall. How would you kind of characterize or like set the mousetrap for the second half of the story to get people come back next week?
Well, you know, we've kind of alluded to, we've kind of alluded to what's going on with Ruby, right? You know, it's been both covert in some of the lines and it's been overt, you know, when talking about, when talking about Hartley's pistol, you know, that was more the overt,
yes.
I feel like. So I feel like the mousetrap really here is, you know, when we're trying to build to her climax, you know that eventually she's going to have to come to terms with the truth. And that's really going to be how Flannery O'Connor presents that to us. How is Ruby going to come to terms with this, and how are the rest of her experiences and her reflections on this ascent up the stairs going to shape that coming to terms with it? So if you're looking for like somebody to jump the shark in here, it's not going to happen. But if you're excited to see,
but we did make it through a whole podcast without making a single climax joke, which I'm really proud of us for, John.
Yeah, we're digitally high-fiving right now. You can't see it, but
let's see if we can do it again next week. So tune in next time. I'm on Twitter at @MeehanEDU. If you like the podcast, you want to subscribe, leave a comment, you want to be a guest, message me for sure. John, you're on Twitter as well?
Yep, at Jonathan Spike.
That's a lot of letters, but it's exactly like it sounds, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Awesome. All right. Good deal. We'll be back next week with another episode. Thank you guys again. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time.